Premier Radio Networks presents Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
It appears as though something has happened in the motorcade route. Something, I repeat, has happened in the motorcade route. There's numerous people running up the hill alongside Elm Street, there by the Stimmons Freeway. Several police officers are rushing up the hill at this time. Stand by just a moment, please. Something has happened in the motorcade route. Stand by, please. Parkland Hospital, there has been a shooting. Parkland Hospital has been advised to stand by for a severe gunshot wound. I repeat, a shooting in the motorcade in the downtown area. Parkland Hospital has been advised to stand by for a severe gunshot wound. The president's car is now going past me. The limousine is now traveling at a very high rate of speed. Secret Service men standing up in the limousine. They are armed with submachine guns. It appears as though someone in the limousine might have been hit by the gunfire.
Just a moment. We have a bulletin coming in. We now switch you directly to Parkland Hospital and KBOX News Director Bill Hampton.
The President of the United States is dead. I have just talked to Father Oscar Hubert of the Holy Trinity Catholic Church. He and another priest tell me that the pair of men have just administered the last rites of the Catholic Church to President Kennedy. I asked the father, is Mr. Kennedy dead? And his quote, he's dead all right.
Hard to believe, nearly 41 years ago, almost to the day, November 22nd, President John F. Kennedy was assassinated. And still, people are trying to figure out exactly what happened. Was there a conspiracy? Were more than one person involved beyond just the theory of the lone gunman? In a moment, our very special three-hour coverage on the assassination of JFK with three guests. The first this hour, Jim Fetzer, a professor of philosophy at the University of Minnesota. He's written a book called The American Assassination, The Strange Death of Senator Paul Wellstone, and also a number of other great books on the JFK assassination, Assassination Science, Murder in Dealey Plaza, and the Great Zapruder Film Hoax. Jim Fetzer is a professor of philosophy at the University of Minnesota in Duluth, has published extensively in the philosophy of science. Jim has edited three books on the death of JFK, which include Assassination Science, Murder in Dealey Plaza, and the Great Zapruder Film Hoax. He also maintains a website devoted to this and related subjects at assassinationscience.com. In addition, Jim has appeared on more than 250 radio and talk shows discussing the death of JFK. He is our guest on our first hour of our JFK investigation show. Jim, welcome back. How are you?
Oh, thanks, George. A pleasure to be with you.
Likewise indeed. As a matter of fact, is there anything conclusive, do you know, on this digital tape analysis that they were going to be working on? Scientists, apparently, Jim, Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory in August said they were going to work on the tape of the policeman. Apparently, he had his dictaphone belt on, and I just no results yet, I'm told, but I'm not sure.
Well, it was a study published in a British forensic journal, by a fellow named Donald Thomas that showed that the reasons that had been offered for discounting the acoustical evidence, which was the basis for the House Select Committee during its reinvestigation in 77-78, concluding that there had been a conspiracy, that there had been at least one additional shot from the grassy knoll, which ironically had missed, has already shown that the objections to it are untenable and that, in fact, the evidence is perfectly viable. And indeed, if the House Select Committee had conducted a more elaborate study using a more extensive array of microphones, they might have been able to establish that shots had been fired from other locations than just the two for which they tested. In fact, when I discussed this with Donald Thomas during a conference in Dallas a couple of years ago, I asked him whether the array of microphones was sufficiently sophisticated to have distinguished between shots fired from the sixth floor of the book depository versus the second floor of the Dell Tex building, and he conceded what I was sure was the case, that they were not, because While their analysis supported three shots from that general area, it wasn't sufficient to show they'd been fired from the sixth floor. He said they adopted that position as a matter of political expediency, not scientific accuracy.
Now, each guest that will be on tonight has his or her own view on the assassination. Jim, in your particular case, let me ask you right from the outset, what do you think happened on that horrible day on November 22nd, 1963?
Well, after 12 years of study with the best qualified individuals to ever investigate the case, George, it's quite evident that this was a meticulously planned and carefully executed assassination involving multiple gunmen who fired many shots. The Secret Service set him up. We have more than 15 indications of Secret Service complicity in the assassination, including not welding down the manhole covers, not covering the open windows, allowing the crowd to spill out into the street, telling the 112th Military Intelligence Unit to stand down in improper motorcade route, putting the vehicles in the wrong position that the president would be way up front, making the motorcycle patrolman stay back from him to come no further than the rear wheels, the driver pulling the limousine to a halt to make sure, in Dealey Plaza, after bullets began to be fired, to make sure the man would be killed, getting a bucket and sponge and washing blood and brains out of the vehicle in Parkland, taking the x-rays which had been exposed and developed, and taking the photographs of the autopsy exposed but not yet developed, and the next time we find them, they've been altered and changed, and then taking the vehicle, which was a crime scene on wheels, back to Ford Motor Company on Monday, the day of the formal state funeral, and completely rebuilding it from the ground up, replacing a windshield that had a through-and-through hole in it. I mean, the Secret Service complicity is the key to understanding the crime, George, because it had to be very high level. The assassination itself appears to have involved gunmen from the mafia, the CIA, and the military. There appear to have been shooters at six different locations who fired a total of 8, 9, or 10 shots. Jack himself was hit 4 different times, once in the throat by a shot that passed through the windshield, once in the back 5.5 inches down below his collar, a shallow shot that had no point of exit, and then twice in the head after the driver brought the limousine to a halt. Once in the back of the head, he fell forward. Jack eased him back up, was looking him right in the face, George, when he was hit in the right temple with a frangible or exploding bullet, which blew his brains out the back of that weakened cranium, already shattered from a bullet to the back of the head with such force that the motorcycle patrolman to the left rear thought he himself had been shot. A triangular chunk of his skull, of course, was found there in the grass the next day, but when it was turned over to the Secret Service, to the FBI, like other important evidence in this case, it simply disappeared.
My God.
Where the FBI covered it all up, and it appears to have been overseen and orchestrated by J. Edgar Hoover and Lyndon Johnson with the complicity of Alan Dulles and financing from Texas oilmen.
You know, Jim, I was 13 years old at the time. I do remember my mother just crying her eyes out. Kennedy, and this is from the mind of a 13-year-old at the time, was tremendously loved by the great American public, yet there must have been then a group of people, I don't know how many, who couldn't stand him, who hated him. Why? What did he do wrong?
Oh, great controversy. Of course, he was Catholic, and that upset a lot of people who were suspicious that this meant the Pope was going to run the country. He was promoting integration in the South, and lots of Southerners resented that. Plus, Dallas itself was the center, really, of right-wing political activity in the country. The Texas oil men wanted to preserve the oil depletion allowance, which Jack was threatening to cut. The mafia thought he had betrayed them by having Bobby relentlessly crack down. They also wanted to regain the resorts and casinos in Cuba, in Havana, where they were running the biggest money laundering operation in the Western Hemisphere. The CIA was afraid he was going to shatter it to bits. The Joint Chiefs were upset with Jack because he had not invaded Cuba against their unanimous recommendation. He'd gone ahead and signed an above-ground test ban treaty with the Soviet Union against their unanimous opposition. Now he's pulling our forces out of Vietnam, where they thought a stand had to be taken against godless communism. They were perceiving Jack Kennedy as part of the problem, not the solution. J. Edgar Hoover wanted to stay on as the director of the FBI. Lyndon Johnson wanted to become president of all of the people. It was a bizarre assortment of individuals, precisely as Jack Ruby observed.
How do you think, I can only imagine this for a moment, some one person initially had to concoct this plan to assassinate Kennedy. It had to start somewhere with somebody. How do you think that happened?
Well, it's possible. There's an interesting book that appears to be based upon phony documents, but which offer, it's entitled Regicide by Gregory Douglass. And it's a clever use of what I consider to be disinformation. It's like a recent CIA document that has emerged that claims that Oswald was working for the CIA as early as 1957, but it has too low a classification stamp and it appears to be a fake, so that people will assume, once they know the documents are fraudulent, that the content in the document must be wrong. It's like the CBS sting with the George Bush documents. What was crucial about his military record there is that the administrative assistant who had worked for the commanding officer, who had written those documents that said that he was unqualified to fly and so forth, said the content was accurate, but that it had been retyped or redone on some other
She said the content's accurate, but the documents probably weren't real.
And the inference is, George, that since the documents aren't real, you assume that the content must be false.
Well, that's what happens. That's
now,
true.
In the case of this regicide book, you see, there's documents from the Soviet Union, though you don't have the Russian originals, you have an English translation that substantiates a three-shot scenario. There's supposed to be a Defense Intelligence Agency three-shot scenario, which is striking in their convergence.
Mm-hmm.
There were 8, 9, or 10 shots. But it says that James Jesus Angleton, the legendary chief of counterintelligence, had concluded that the President Kennedy was sharing information with Khrushchev, Nikita Khrushchev. And he did this by having distinctive versions of highly classified documents, so he could tell by the way in which information was translated, or potentially tell, which of the specific documents had been compromised. And he discovered, according to this characterization, that Jack himself had been sharing this information with Khrushchev. Now, personally, I think it's not at all unreasonable he might have been doing that, because the CIA had discovered it had been lying to him.
A year later, Kennedy would have come up for re-election, 1964. I assume he would have won, right?
Well, I think in a walk.
Yeah.
I think that's absolutely right. I mean, you know, somebody like Barry Goldwater was a piece of cake in Lyndon Johnson's hands. And, of course, I mean, Johnson was this brilliant, completely masterful politician, probably the most interesting figure ever astride the American political scene, because he had so many strengths, both for good but also for evil. I mean, this was a man who was deeply involved in the assassination, and we have a lot of information about that. And it's been fascinating, George, how over this past year there's been a furious disinformation campaign going on at multiple levels to try to discount all the significant research that's taken place over the last decade, including the discovery that the autopsy x-rays have been altered, that another brain was substituted for that of JFK, that the Zapruder film was systematically recreated, and that the Patsy Lee Oswald was framed using manufactured evidence.
In Oswald's case, there's no doubt he was there. Do you think he even knew what was going on, or was he part of this larger conspiracy?
Well, Wagner Carr, the Attorney General of Texas at the time, launched his own investigation and discovered that Oswald had been working as an informant for the FBI. He had informant number 179. He'd been being paid for a couple of years, $200 a month, right up to the time of the assassination. It appears he was working in an intelligence capacity. I think he was on the fringe. He certainly knew Jack Ruby. There are multiple sources who saw him with Ruby on one occasion or another, including Beverly Oliver, who took a famous motion picture from the side opposite, the grass opposite the grassy knoll, which was taken by the FBI and promptly disappeared. She was actually introduced to Lee Oswald as by Jack Ruby as his friend from the CIA. Beverly said she had no idea then, nor does she now, what that really meant, that he was of the CIA. But in fact, Oswald was on the second floor in a lunchroom having a Coke at the time of the assassination, where he may have been awaiting a phone call that never came.
So they may have said, look, something's going to happen, stand by. He probably didn't even know what was going to happen, what was going to go on. And then, boom, the assassination occurs, and he's in shock. He runs, right?
Well, we have multiple reports from coworkers who saw him in that vicinity about 11:45, at 12, at 12:15, as late as 12:25. Carolyn Arnold, who was the executive secretary of the vice president of the book depository, saw him in the lunchroom. He was confronted there by a motorcycle patrolman named Marion Baker within 90 seconds after the assassination. That's curious all by itself, because the lunchroom is way in the back. It's not an obvious place to go. Even if you think there's an assassin in the building trying to escape, you wouldn't go there. Nevertheless, he did go there. Held Oswald in his sights until his supervisor, Roy Truly, came along and assured him this man worked in the book depository. They both said in the written statements, which appeared in the Warren report, that he was calm, perfectly collected, seemed absolutely normal, wasn't out of breath or anything, except a little startled, as anyone would be if they were held, you know, suddenly confronted by a police officer. Now, determining that work wasn't going to go on that day, Oswald left, apparently, right out the front door, where he nearly ran into Jim Lehrer of McNeil Lehrer Report, who asked for information about where he could find a telephone. He then went and boarded a bus. The bus got clogged in traffic, so he got off and took a taxi. In fact, a little old lady wanted the cab, so he graciously offered it to this little old lady. I mean, this has got to be the first time in history that an assassin made his escape by way of public transportation.
Well, who killed J.D. Tippit, the police officer?
That's a real curiosity. It's very obvious, however, that Oswald did not shoot Tippit. For him to have gone from his rooming house over to the location where Tippit was would have taken him way out of his way when he was headed for the Texas Theater, where I think there was a prearranged rendezvous with a handler there. Aquila Clemens, a woman sitting across the street, observed that there had been two persons who shot Tippit, neither of whom resembled Oswald, which corresponds with two different manufacturers of ammunition found on the scene. Plus, the ammo had been automatically ejected at the scene, and it had been initialed by the first officer on the scene. Oswald, however, had a revolver, which, of course, doesn't automatically eject its shell casings. And later, a substitution was made so that the ammunition now was from a revolver, but it no longer had the initials that had been placed upon it. So there's a very good discussion of this in Robert Grosin's book, The Search for Lee Harvey Oswald, by the way.
How close was Jim Garrison to getting to the truth?
Well, he was definitely on the edge, on the periphery, and working toward the center. I mean, David Ferry and some of the right-wingers in New Orleans had been responsible for helping to set up Oswald with his pseudo-persona as a pro-Castro communist sympathizer. The idea was supposed to be, I think, that you pin the tail on this Castro-ite. And the whole trip business of going down to Mexico City, which appears to have been a charade with somebody else impersonating Lee Oswald there. Photographs of the CIA don't look like him at all. Voice recordings don't resemble his voice. J. Edgar Hoover even put out an announcement to all of his area special agents that someone was impersonating Lee Oswald in Mexico. Well, as soon as you know that, you realize there's a conspiracy at work here.
I remember a picture in our Detroit News newspaper of a picture of a guy coming out of a U.S. embassy in Mexico.
Right.
And there was like a caption says, "Is this Oswald?" And it surely didn't look like the Oswald that I had seen.
No, actually, it looks tremendously like a fellow named Jim Hicks, who claimed to have been a communications coordinator for the assassination. He actually can find photographs of him in Dealey Plaza with an antenna hanging out the back of his pocket. But it's surely not Lee Oswald. And I say, this is so stunning, you know, that somebody should be impersonating him there, that it implies a conspiracy all by itself.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So what have we learned over the last 40 years, Jim, that they didn't know back in 1963, 64?
Well, a lot of it has to do with the cover-up, because really it turns out that killing the man isn't the hard part. The hard part is covering it up and trying to preserve the, you know, the loyalty of the American people toward their government. So David W. Mandick, who has a background in physics and also in medicine and with x-rays, has gone into the National Archives repeatedly and discovered that the original autopsy x-rays aren't, that they're copies and fabrications, and that the patch has been imposed to conceal the massive blowout to the back of the head, and that another x-ray has been altered by adding a 6.5-millimeter metallic slice to implicate this obscure weapon Oswald is supposed to have used. Ironically, the death certificates, the Warren Report, even this book, Case Closed, by Gerald Posner, all claim the president was killed by high-velocity bullets, and yet the Mannlicher Carcano only has a muzzle velocity of 2,000 feet per second, so it's not a high-velocity weapon. Compare that with a Bushmaster that was used by the D.C. snipers. That weapon has a 3,000 foot per second muzzle velocity, which makes it an actual high-velocity weapon. So they changed the autopsy evidence. They redid the photographs, too, and another brain was substituted. There were two different brain examinations, and during the second, a substitution was made of someone else's brain. And the reason is, once you patch up that massive hole, there's nowhere for all that brain material to go. The man lost about half of his brains in Dealey Plaza. Also, we've discovered that the Zapruder film, that whole movie of the assassination, has been systematically recreated to George to conceal, you know, the true causes of death. In fact, a fellow at the National Photographic Interpretation Center by the name of Homer McMahon was brought a film that night that may have been, you know, an original authentic film of the assassination, was asked to study it over and over again, which he did to prepare a briefing board showing impacts of bullets on passengers in the limousine.
I want to talk with you when we come back about that Zapruder film, Jim, and we'll also open up the phone lines to give people an opportunity to chat with you a little bit later on this hour. I'm George Norrie. This with our first guest into our three-hour extravaganza into the... And welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie, Jim Fetzer, I guess. Jim, let's talk a little bit before we go to the calls of the Zapruder film again. So talk a little bit about Abraham Zapruder, first of all. Who is the guy? Who was he? What was he doing there?
Well, ostensibly, he was a local businessman who just happened to be in the vicinity with his secretary. Interestingly, he suffered from vertigo, which makes it very odd that he should climb up on this low concrete column. It happens to be the only position that could be visible all around Dealey Plaza from the various locations where shooters appear to have been situated. So it's not at all clear that Zapruder was merely an innocent bystander in this matter. His role has been the subject of discussion of numerous students of the case, including especially John Costella, who's an expert on the physics of light and the motion of moving objects, who has become the leading expert on technical expert on the film today. For this occasion, George, for appearing on your show, I put together a JFK introductory seminar on my website that includes three pieces. The first is the Lone Nutter Refutation that proves that the magic bullet theory is completely indefensible and therefore proves that the Warren Report, the House Select Committee, and the Gerald Posner's case closed are utterly indefensible accounts of the assassination. They're not just theories of the assassination. They're theories that have been proven to be false. Then there's a piece by David Mantic on the JFK autopsy materials. This is more advanced, but it's been written to make it accessible to a wide public. And then perhaps most interestingly for your audience, I had John Costello put together an introduction to the JFK assassination film hoax, so you can go on my website and you can find an introduction to the evidence that indicates that the film has been, in fact, recreated using sophisticated techniques of optical printing and special effects.
Well, did we have that kind of sophistication back in 1963, 64?
Oh, yes, we did. That was one of the burdens of the book, The Great Zapruder Film Hoax, was to establish that there was the technical competence to have altered the film at that point in time.
What do you think the original film might have shown?
Well, it would have included the driver bringing the limousine to a halt. And remember now, we have Homer McMahon's account, you know, that there were 6 to 8 impacts from at least 3 different directions. Now, we have Jack hit 4 times and Connolly 3. That's a number 7 between 6 and 8. So it would have shown a whole lot more going on than we have available today. We have lots and lots of evidence, including individuals who've actually seen, in addition to Homer McMahon, who've seen the more complete film, and who confirmed what we had inferred would have been present in that case. So what Costello has done is go through and give you, you know, lots of the evidential indications that the film was, in fact, recreated. And there were technical reasons, by the way, George, why it had to be recreated. There's a feature in the sprocket hole area where the so-called ghost images reflect the content of prior frames for each frame. So you actually have a linkage. There's kind of a chain, a photographic chain, that relates each frame to prior frames, so that if you have a discontinuation, if you were to just change some of the frames, you'd have a discontinuity in this chain that links them. Now, these big splices that are well known at 155, 157, and at 207 through 212, create discontinuities in that chain in the sprocket area, which suggests it's possible that the basic raw film for putting together the present version had 3 different origins from 3 different films. And we believe multiple cameramen were in the Dealey Plaza at the time of the assassination and contributed, you know, raw footage for this purpose.
How did they get the film from Zapruder? How did they get it away from him? What happened?
Well, there's an official story about that, of him, you know, calling the Secret Service. Secret Service comes to meet him at the processing lab, the Jameson Film Lab, and all that. But the fact is that it's very hard to tell how many films were taken. There's one copy appears to have been made that simply disappeared. No matter who knows how many copies of that copy may have been made. This is the kind of thing that's discussed in great detail in the Great Zapruder Film Hoax book.
Well, and I can't believe, Jim, with all the people the hundreds of people who were lined up there, that there was only one person there with a film camera.
Oh, no, you're right. There were, you know, there were about 8 or 10 or 12. I mean, some like Beverly Oliver just had their, you know, their film confiscated. I mean, just she had one of the most important films taken in Dealey Plaza because she was shooting right toward the grassy knoll and would have probably caught any shooters who were located in that vicinity. Gordon Arnold, who was a soldier on the other side, had a camera and was taking photographs. But there appear to have been others distributed there that were, you know, professional quality photographers.
Lots of people have questions for you, Jim, so let us go straight to them. Wild Card Line, welcome to Coast, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hey, George. Hey, Jim.
Hi. Yes.
This is Dan. How you doing? Driving a truck.
Good, Dan. Go ahead, Dan.
Been waiting a year to talk to you, my friend.
Oh, great.
Been waiting a year, my friend.
Well, go for it.
Okay, I'm going to get one point in. I'm going to try and get a couple in. Let's talk about the gun and the cartridge. You just stated, and you stated last year when you were on the show, that that's a low velocity projectile.
Right.
That is untrue, my friend. Okay. Let me finish. Please, let me finish, because you've already stated about it. Now, It's a low velocity projectile. The 223 Remington or the 5.56 millimeter, which you just compared it to, is a 55 grain bullet coming out at 3,400 feet per second. You cannot compare those two. The Carcano bullet is over twice the size of that bullet, and it comes out at a little over, right around 2,200 feet per second. It's very, very similar to the 308 Winchester. Are you familiar with that cartridge?
Look, I've got an expert on the rifle who has discussed these in great detail. And
are you familiar with the 308 Winchester cartridge?
I think what you're saying is obfuscating the issues. It's not a high velocity weapon.
You stated that gun was a low velocity projectile, and the ammo could not have committed the crime.
Yeah.
I'm stating to you that the 308 Winchester is very similar to that cartridge, almost identical, and that's what NATO uses as their 800 to 1,000 meter sniper rifle.
Look, the damage to the skull, let me just...
The damage to the skull has been proven by 90% of the... 90%
listen,
of
the man had massive damage to his skull.
That's
this
right.
This is a copper-jacketed military bullet. It doesn't
explode.
He has metal particles distributed through his brain from a frangible bullet. He had bullets... There were bullets firing from
behind. Are you saying it was a fragmented soft-point bullet that took his head off? Are you saying that was a fragmented...
Yeah, there was a frangible bullet that entered his right temple.
Okay.
And you find these distribution of metal parts, possibly mercury, throughout the throughout the brain and the skull photograph.
Dan, very quickly, just tell me, what is your point, though? What are you trying to prove?
My point is this. He's stating, his state of fact is, first of all, he states ballistically that the cartridge wasn't capable of doing it. That's right there is the fallacy. If you're talking about ridiculousness about how one person couldn't have killed him, I'm telling you that saying that the bullet couldn't have done it is ridiculous. It absolutely could have from a Carcano rifle. I own two of them, and I'm telling you it could have done the damage, and it could have been just as accurate. And all he needed was one shot. As long as the first shot hits its mark, who cares where the next two shots go?
All right, okay. And that's his point, Jim.
Well, it's really just trading on an equivocation. I mean, look, I used to supervise recruit training at the same recruit depot and rifle range where Oswald took his training. He wasn't trained to fire a bolt-action weapon. He was using an M1, which is semi-automatic. He wasn't trained to use a sight. He wasn't trained to fire down from a tall building. He was actually on the second floor. He didn't have the ability to do it. His marksmanship was pathetic. He dropped 21 points in 2 years. He didn't even qualify in 1958, which is quite strange because all Marines are required to qualify. He appears to have been undergoing language training probably at the Monterey School at the time. The man was hit four different times by a shot from in front, went through the windshield, shot from behind, from his back, probably from the top of the county records building, back of the head, probably from the Dow Tex, then the right temple from the vicinity of the grassy knoll in the intersection with the triple underpass. I mean, this kind of argument is a complete diversion. We have massive evidence about the alteration of the X-ray, the substitution of brain, the recreation of the film, the manufacture of evidence to frame Oswald. It shouldn't have been necessary to manufacture evidence and to frame a guilty man. He wasn't in the position. He didn't have the motive. I mean, the whole case is overwhelming for a conspiracy with multiple shooters. And to just quibble about whether it's high velocity or not high velocity, listen, that's a copper-jacketed military standard bullet. It doesn't explode. It would not have created a fraction of the damage that was done to this man's skull. This man's skull was devastated. Well, one medical technician who described the skull said it looked like someone had put a bomb inside his head and it had gone off. That's not the sort of effect you'd get from a military copper-jacketed bullet. This man is just wrong.
And what it does tell you, though, is that the theories of conspiracy versus those who don't believe it will go on and on and on.
Except, George, if you look at the evidence, you know, what we did was to go back and reconstruct the case from the ground up, from the autopsy x-rays usually taken to be the best evidence, and rework the case by testing the authenticity of the evidence. And once you do that, actually, it all falls out in a very straightforward fashion, which was much of the burden of murder in Dealey Plaza, just to show you when you reconstruct the case after you've identified the authenticity from the authentic from the inauthentic, that the case really does fit together very clearly. A little old lady borrowed a friend of mine's book when he went in for a dental examination and just read the preface and the prologue where I lay out 16 smoking guns. And when he came out, he asked her how she liked the book, and she said, "Why, you know, it's all very straightforward. She wished the government had told us what actually happened to begin with." It's not that complicated once you test for authenticity, which the government, of course, deliberately never did. And even when the House Select Committee reinvestigated the case, they didn't do either. It's not the sort of thing that even forensic experts ordinarily do, for example, to test x-rays to determine whether they're authentic, other than by a superficial comparison of the dentures, which shows it was originally a genuine JFK x-ray, but then they didn't subject it to the kind of test that Mantic did to ascertain that it had been altered.
First-time caller line, you're up with Jim Fetzer on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hey, this is Joe.
Hi, Joe.
I'm calling from Duluth, Minnesota.
Okay, go ahead, Joe.
Okay, I just wanted to reiterate Jim's point a little bit about the weapon that Lee Harvey Oswald was using. And isn't it true that it would have been nearly impossible for him to make that shot, especially considering his skill level and the open sights on the weapon and from the position that he was at?
Well, there are many reasons why. If Oswald had actually been on the sixth floor instead of on the second floor where he was waiting for a phone call and drinking a Coke, he would have taken his shots as the limousine was heading to Houston right toward him. The body would be getting closer and closer, the head larger and larger. It would be an easier and easier shot. I say, you know, even someone of Oswald's mediocre marksmanship ability would have been able to make that shot. It would have been irresistible. You would not wait until the limousine turned the corner from Houston onto Elm, and you had to fire through a tree. I mean, this is one of the great manifest absurdities of the government's position, that this man would have waited until he had to fire through a tree, and you'd have to catch just the moment when the limousine was visible between the branches of the tree. It's an absurd account, and the kind of shots that it would have required is fantastic. And, you know,
hitting a branch, for crying out loud?
I know, it's ridiculous. In fact, some of the reconstructions trying to justify the Warren Report claim that the bullet did hit a branch, and that's the one that was deflected and injured the distant bystander James Tague. So it was the second or the third, and the third that actually hit. But that's, you know, that gets worse and worse. I mean, it's your first shot that's going to be your most reliable, where you take the most time before you set it off. I mean, and you can expect there ought to be a response, which, of course, actually didn't take place in this case by the Secret Service, but you'd certainly not be able to count on that.
East of the Rockies, you're up with us on Coast to Coast. Hi.
Hi, George.
Yeah, go ahead, sir.
This is Dan. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Hi, Jim.
Yes.
I was wanting to know if, you know, is there any connection between John Kennedy's killing and Jack Kennedy's killing? That's my first question. And my second one is, what did you think of the movie JFK?
And I think he meant Bobby.
Yeah, I'm sure you meant Bobby.
Bobby, I'm sorry.
Oh, I think Bobby was a loose end because Bobby was threatening to reopen the investigation. He confided to some people, perhaps unwisely, that, you know, he would reopen the case when he had the full powers of the presidency. The Bobby case is pretty clearly Sir Ann Sirhan was a distraction. More bullets were fired than came from his weapon. Bobby was shot behind the right ear from a distance of about an inch and a half. Sir Ann never got closer than a foot and a half or even more to Bobby. So this appears to be a pretty straightforward case of his assassination. The second question about the film JFK, our research suggests that motion picture is the most accurate, complete, and comprehensive presentation of what actually happened in Dealey Plaza ever presented to the American people through the mass media, even though it's too simple by half.
couple more minutes to go, and we'll grab a few more calls, and I want to wrap up with you, Jim, and once again get your theory on why. Let's go to our wild card line. Welcome to Coast. You are on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi. Hi, George. Hi, Jim.
Sure.
This is probably the most fascinating show I've ever heard, and I've been listening for over a decade. Well, real quick, I own an original copy of the Long Beach Press Telegram, and back buried on, like, page 6, it said, "Doctor tells the president's wounds." And this is a Parkland Hospital emergency doctor who's obviously seen thousands of gunshot wounds. And he was pressed, you know, what was the entrance wound? And he said, "In the front of the head," which is absolutely amazing, because you would think somebody, you know, in that stature would know. Exactly.
Yeah, it was actually in the right temple. I mean, and there were lots of witnesses in Dealey Plaza and also at Parkland who described this. We have a couple of physicians who actually drew diagrams of it. You find this stuff in Assassination Science. I had Charles Crenshaw, who actually was there and then 2 days later attended his alleged assassin, draw diagrams of what he observed then. There's another, so I put them right in the book. There are other diagrams by Dr. McClellan that show a massive blowout to the back of the head. But he had this wound at his right temple, right in the hairline. That was the entry point of the shot from in front. And that was the frangible or exploding bullet that, you know, blasted his brains out the back of his head with such great force.
Well, also, real quick, don't you think that bullet caused more change in our history than any other bullet? I mean, there would have been no Reagan, no Nixon.
Yes, you've had a whole succession of presidents who would never have occupied the office but for the death of JFK. That includes Lyndon Johnson, of course, Richard Nixon, Gerald Ford, and almost certainly, though by a more indirect chain, George Herbert Walker Bush, and now, of course, his son, W.
So, Jim Fetzer, if indeed it was a conspiracy, a number of people got involved in the assassination of JFK, in your opinion, why?
Oh, it was for all these policy reasons. They really wanted, apart from the anti-Castro Cubans who had revenge as a motive because they thought JFK had betrayed them, it was really for these policy, very tangible reasons. You know, CIA wanting to retain power, the mafia wanting to regain its resorts and casinos and money laundering operation, wanting to get Bobby off their backs, Hoover wanting to stay on as director. Jack Ruby said two fascinating things. He said that the motives were very tangible and that this was a bizarre assortment if you ever put it together. And if you realize you're talking about Texas oilmen, the mafia in collusion with the director of the FBI and the vice president of the United States to assassinate the president, it is a bizarre assortment and their motives were all too tangible.
They somehow all kind of meshed together, Jim Fetzer, at the right time or the wrong time for JFK and probably the country too, huh?
Blackest chapter in American history, George, bar none.
We've never been the same, Jim.
We haven't. We have never recovered, and the effects are lasting and to this day.
Someone had emailed me and said, did Kennedy write some kind of a note that would be opened in 50 years? I don't know. Would you?
They may be thinking of Jackie. There's a report that Jackie put her recollections and her opinions about the assassination into a confidential file that's only to be opened something like 20 years after her death. Now, I think that may be true, but not Jack.
I would love to see what that says, wouldn't you?
I think she had every reason to suspect the people that we're talking about here, Hoover and Lyndon, were very close. They lived adjacent to one another in Washington. They were very, very tight politically. They knew how to wheel and deal in Washington. They knew how to manipulate people. They were a mighty force to reckon with, and I think that they were ultimately responsible for this event.
And that is the theory of Jim Fetzer. When we come back, January Jones, she has a very strange one, the love triangle theory. Back in a moment.
Subscribe to the After Dark newsletter online at www.coasttocoastam.com. Just click through the orange type to the secure server.
January Jones is an award-winning author of the controversial book, Oh No, Jackie O. She's had a long, lifelong fascination with the Kennedy family and the elegant Jacqueline Bouvier Kennedy. Her interest in the JFK assassination case began the day after that fateful event. None of the controversial scenarios around the assassination ever made sense to her as to how and why anybody would dare to kill such a beloved president at the time. After tracking the life of the Jackie O for her book, January Jones began to dig deeper into the facts surrounding Jackie's life following the assassination. Her conclusion, once you hear the entire story, is so glaringly obvious. Well, you'll never look at the case the same way again. She's our guest this hour on Coast to Coast, January Jones. Hi, January. How are you?
Hi, George. I'm fine. Nice to be back visiting with you again.
Indeed. And when you say that, it is because you were a guest of mine many years ago in St. Louis.
Yes.
You remember that?
I do.
Now, you have, of all the theories that I have read and looked at and guests I've talked with, yours is, I think, one of the different ones.
Absolutely.
Jackie, let's go back a little bit, because I want to kind of build to this scenario that you have come up with. Because it may not be all that far-fetched, quite frankly, but it is one that a lot of people just kind of glare right over because they're more concerned with Cuba, the mafia, you know, the CIA, and all these other issues.
Right.
They don't look at passion, a crime of passion, which is what this might have been. As well. Let's go back a little bit and tell me, how did you start putting the pieces together for your theory?
Well, George, as you know, I followed the Kennedy family now for over 41 years, and I, just like everyone else, I was still asking who killed JFK. This assassination was a defining moment for my generation. During my research, I came to the startling conclusion that this was not a political assassination. When you think about it, there was no coup d'etat, no overthrow of the government. The same political party stayed in power. So if this was not a political assassination, what was it? My belief was that it was a crime of passion, a classic love triangle. One very wealthy, powerful, ruthless man wanted another wealthy, powerful man's wife, and guess what? He got her.
Yeah, he did get her. There's no doubt about that. Now, let's talk about that relationship. How did Jackie meet Ari?
Well, actually, she spent 17 days with Aristotle Onassis prior to the assassination. September 1st, she was on his luxury yacht, the Christina, for 17 days in the Aegean Sea. Jacqueline and Aristotle were the only two on that cruise who were unaccompanied by a spouse or significant other.
No, wait a minute now. She's married to Kennedy.
Right.
And she's on Aristotle Onassis's yacht?
Yes, yes.
How did Kennedy permit this?
Well, he did not want her to go. However, she insisted on going. And they had an upcoming election, and JFK wanted to keep Jacqueline happy. And so he allowed her to go on this cruise. It was quite...
With another guy?
Yes, yes, as his guest of honor on his ship. Onassis knew that politically it was going to be a very difficult thing, and he offered not to go on the cruise. However, Jacqueline insisted that he accompany her on the cruise. And when she left his ship, he gave her over $50,000 in precious gems and jewels, and my theory, precious promises.
This is mind-boggling.
Yes.
I mean, the first lady is on a yacht,
yes,
owned by some billionaire at the time, some shipping,
yes,
giant.
He was one of the most unsavory men in the world at that time. As a matter of fact, JFK forbid him to even enter the country because he didn't want to have any association with the man.
So those two guys didn't get along at all.
No. The Onassis-Kennedy connection goes back, George, all the way to the father. Joe Kennedy and Aristotle Onassis did business together in the 30s. Joe Kennedy was the head of the Maritime Commission, and one of his assignments was to get rid of the Liberty ships and to sell them to American citizens or corporations. Well, interestingly enough, those ships were sold to Aristotle Onassis, and they became part of his empire.
I see. So that's how he started accumulating all his wealth.
Yes. At the time of this assassination, Onassis was one of the most wealthy, powerful men in this world. People in this country do not realize the extent of his empire. It's interesting to note when you track his activities during World War II, it would appear that he actually helped to broker that war. He supplied oils and munitions to both sides during that conflict, and his ships were welcome into all the ports. None of his ships or any of his men were ever harmed during that war.
So he stayed relatively neutral, but he helped everybody.
Well, actually, he stayed in New York, and he stayed there counting his money.
Lots of money.
Yes, yes.
Now, if Jackie was on his yacht, you said, what, 15 days before the assassination?
17 days,
17
yes.
days. Mm-hmm. She obviously knew him before that.
Well, actually, she and Jack had met him. Joe Kennedy arranged for them to go aboard the yacht in the early in the 1950s as a guest of Winston Churchill. Now, Onassis was one of these people who collected people, and Churchill was one of his prize collections. He had him as a guest on his yacht all the time. And Joe Kennedy arranged for Jackie and Jack to go aboard the yacht. And after their visit, Churchill and Onassis commented to each other that they weren't that impressed with Jack, but they were quite taken with Mrs. Kennedy.
What was it that Jackie found attractive about Aristotle? You know, because didn't he wear those heavy glasses? He had an eye disease.
Yeah.
And Kennedy, good-looking guy. You know, maybe Jackie, was Jackie aware of Kennedy's philandering?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
So maybe she lost respect for him.
Yeah, absolutely. This was a political marriage. They had separate lives. They had separate bedrooms. And Jackie was there because he had to have a Catholic wife to become president.
So she really probably wasn't in love with Kennedy, the way that one would think a couple should be in love.
Absolutely. I think she was more, I think she liked Jack. I think, however, they both had other people in their lives, other interests. And it was the way their marriage was set up from the get-go. Their Jack's father's marriage was the model for his marriage. Jack's father always had other women in his life, even coming into their home. And here Jack was at the White House, and as we now know, the White House was quite a place of activity. It was a busy little beehive for Jack.
So the yacht trip occurs.
Yes.
I guess without witnesses other than the Greek crew,
oh, yeah.
We really don't know what happened on that yacht.
Well, the people who were on that yacht commented afterwards, after the cruise was over, that it had been in a romantic interlude.
Uh-huh.
Jackie was quite taken with Onassis, and you ask, you know, what did she see in him? Well, he was a short, unattractive man. However, he was a Greek man. He had tremendous amount of charisma. And when he stood on top of his money, he was probably the tallest man in the world.
Well, and looks isn't everything, you know, if you have the package.
Yes, as we see from Jacqueline's life as it continues, looks weren't everything for her. She was attracted to men who were probably not your classic handsome movie star types,
right,
like Jack. However, they nurtured her. They took care of her. And
she liked the power?
Yes, yes.
Okay, so somewhere along this yacht cruise,
mm-hmm.
And I'm speculating here as a guy, mm-hmm. Aristotle Onassis is falling in love.
Absolutely.
And he's saying, I got to get this woman away from this guy.
Right.
How do I do it?
I think one night under the stars, it's very romantic that they're alone. Onassis would look into her eyes and say, Jacqueline, I adore you. I worship you. There's nothing I wouldn't do for you, nothing I wouldn't give you, Now let me ask you a question.
Mm-hmm.
If your husband were out of the picture, would I have a chance?
And he didn't, of course, say dead. He just merely said out of the picture.
Yes.
And she says?
Well, she certainly would consider him if her husband were out of the picture, wouldn't you?
And so all of a sudden, Aristotle Onassis, a little light bulb goes on in his head, according to your theory.
Mm-hmm.
Bing. And what does he start to think?
Well, as being one of the most wealthy, powerful, savory men in the world, he looks at Jacqueline and he thinks, I want her. I want her, and I'm going to get her.
And they're not going to divorce, right?
I know. Divorce was out of the question because Jack was a Catholic. And do you realize if Jackie at that time had divorced Jack Kennedy, she would have become one of the most hated women in the world.
To say nothing about his reelection chances.
Absolutely. It was divorce was never an option for Jacqueline Kennedy.
All right. So Aristotle then says, I got to come up with something else.
Mm-hmm.
What happens?
Well, my theory is that with his connections, he did get connected with the mafia. However, it was the mafia in Europe. The assassins that were hired were the best in the world. Their assignment was to kill one man only. Their assignment was to escape and to leave no trail. They were hired out of Marseille, France, and the particular assassin that I name in my book, incidentally, George, this is the same man that A&E named in their five-part series, The Men Who Killed Kennedy.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The man that I named, he arrived with his crew in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. They were there for 48 hours. They completed their assignment, and they escaped through Canada.
How soon after the assassination did Aristotle see Jackie again?
Oh, isn't this interesting? Aristotle Onassis, on the day of the assassination, was in Hamburg, Germany, christening his newest ship the Olympic Chivalry. Interesting name
yeah.
for a ship. And at that moment, when he found out of the assassination, he boarded one of his Olympic Airlines planes, and he flew directly to Washington, D.C. When he arrived there, he went directly to the White House, and I have documented that upon his arrival, he spoke privately to Mrs. Kennedy with no other witnesses, and then he proceeded to stay as Mrs. Kennedy's guest in the White House during the funeral.
Now, I thought he was banned from even coming into the country or coming to the White House, so she let him in.
Yes, absolutely. JFK had banned him from entering the country. So now you have one man lying in a coffin in the East Room and another man who is his enemy in the guest room.
How soon did he start seeing her?
Oh, right
after
away.
That. So right. They were an item right away, or was she a little smarter than that?
Oh, they were very, very discreet. He sent her flowers, and he sent her gifts and many presents for the children. And he did see her. However, they were very discreet about it. Actually, the only thing I think they did that was fairly indiscreet was the following Christmas after JFK died, Jacqueline Kennedy, during the holiday season, boarded an Olympic Airways jet in New York. She was the only passenger. She flew to Paris, France. She disembarked from the jet. She did not have to go through customs. And she was met by Aristotle Onassis, and he swept her away, and they had a private 3-day interlude at his apartment in Paris.
What year did she get married to him?
They actually were married in 1968, and they were married 4 months after the assassination of Robert Kennedy. Robert Kennedy and Onassis were documented enemies. They did not like each other.
Her true wealth came from Onassis, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. When Jack died, Jacqueline was left $25,000 in cash, and the interest only to the children's trust funds to be terminated upon all of these benefits to be terminated upon remarriage. So she was not a wealthy woman. People think because she was a Kennedy, she was wealthy. You had to be born a Kennedy to benefit from Joe Kennedy's money.
Now, why or was Aristotle Onassis investigated for the assassination?
Well, actually, he was never really a suspect in the JFK assassination. I mean, that was one of those situations where so many people had publicly said they wanted to get rid of Kennedy that when it actually came down, no one really knew who did it, and certainly no one wanted to take the blame for the assassination. So I think there was this conspiracy of silence where everyone kind of shuffled everything under the rug through the Warren Commission, which they presented to the American public. And everyone wanted to just life to go on and let's forget about it.
I was talking briefly last hour about Jackie Kennedy's private papers. They've been sealed, right?
Right. And interestingly enough, George, she is the only first lady in the history of this country to seal her private papers for 80 years.
80 years?
80
That's
years.
The date? So that opens them up 2040-something?
2044, yes. I've just finished a movie script called Jackie's Story 2044, and in this movie script, it pushes us ahead to the year 2044 when her papers are opened.
Any idea? Well, I guess, how can you speculate on that?
Well, it's easy to speculate. I think that we now know that she didn't want to keep it a secret that her husband cheated on her. Everyone knew that. Obviously, there is something that she would like to tell the American public in the year 2044. I think she will step to the forefront. I think we will see that Jacqueline was not a Stepford wife. I think we will see that she was brilliant. She's the heroine in this tragedy, and she's a survivor.
Is there anybody alive right now who knows what might be in those private papers?
I do not think so. I think these papers have been sealed to protect her children.
Where are they now?
You know, that's a good question. I would think they probably would be with a private attorney. I can't imagine that they would have been sent to the Kennedy Library sealed, because I think she would have worried that they would have been opened and destroyed.
Well,
I don't know where they are.
Aristotle Onassis, of course, did not lead a very pleasant life himself. His tragic death of his son, I think, almost destroyed him, did it not?
Actually, when his son died, it was the beginning of his decline. And at that time, he blamed Jackie for his unfortunate. He said that she was a curse upon him and that he was being punished for marrying her. His daughter hated Jackie. After he died, they came to terms, and she gave Jackie $26 million never to have to see her again.
That was a settlement?
Yes. She got $20 million, and then she also asked for $6 million for taxes.
Must be nice.
Yes. She was a brilliant woman. When we look at Jacqueline Kennedy's life, George, this woman swam with sharks.
Now, let me ask you this.
Mm-hmm.
You are not saying that she knew of the assassination attempt with Ari.
You know, when I first started my research, that was thought was just like something. It was very difficult for me to even go there. However, once my research unfolded, when you look at this realistically, this is a woman who got into bed with two of the most unsavory men in the world. She was a brilliant woman. I think that this was something that she would have had to know to some extent.
Maybe she didn't want to know.
She didn't want to know.
Stay with us, Jack. January Jones, our guest, as we talk about Jackie. Ari and Jack, that's the name of her book, The Tragic Love Triangle. We'll open up the phone lines. I'm sure you've got a question for her. Back in a moment. What do people say about your theory, January, when you talk with them?
Well, usually when we discuss this theory, at first people are incredulous. They just can't. It's just so unbelievable to them. However, after we start talking about it, the light bulb usually goes on, And it comes, the light bulb goes on more quickly with women, particularly women who have been widowed or divorced, women who have needed cash. They get it right away. It's like in the murder mysteries, the butler did it. Well, when you look at a love triangle and one party is eliminated, you must look very carefully and very closely at the two remaining parties.
Every time I hear the song Camelot,
yes,
I think of Kennedy and his administration all the time.
Yes, and what was Camelot? Think about it, George. It was a historical love triangle. JFK was the king. Jacqueline, of course, was the queen.
Guinevere, right?
Guinevere, yes. And who was Lancelot? Well, Lancelot didn't ride in on a white horse. He flew in on Olympic Airways, and he rescued the queen.
Yeah, but Aristotle sure didn't look like Lancelot.
He certainly didn't. However, he was he had a lot of charisma. He had courted some of the most beautiful women in the world. Gloria Swanson was one of his conquests. Also, Maria Callas. He collected people the way other people collect artwork, and he had quite a collection of people. Prince Rainier, Princess Grace were guests on his yacht. He hosted some of the most powerful people in the world. And, of course, when he acquired Jacqueline, she was the crown jewel of his collection.
Let's go to the phones. Wildcard Line, you're up with January Jones on Coast to Coast. Hi.
Hi. This is Tammy. I'm calling from San Antonio.
Sure
thing. Hi, Tammy.
Go ahead.
Hi, January. I have a question. You're talking about these women that Onassis collected, and I always understood that Lee Radziwill also dated him, Jackie's sister.
Yes.
And wasn't she also on that cruise the week before?
Yes, actually, she's the one who brought Jackie to Onassis' attention. She had had an affair with Onassis, and actually Lee had hoped that Onassis would marry her and rescue her. However, Jacqueline was a little bigger fish in the pond, so to speak, and he was enchanted with Jacqueline. Also, interestingly enough, Tammy, we have documented, since all these things have been revealed about Camelot throughout the years, that Lee Radziwill and JFK actually had an affair, too.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
And so I guess it didn't really matter to Jackie if her sister had an affair with her husband, if she was having an affair with her boyfriend.
Exactly.
Oh, man, what a triangle that was.
There didn't seem to be a problem there.
Yeah, it was more than a triangle.
More like a pyramid.
You know, I think in that group of people, the having the affairs wasn't the problem. For Jacqueline, the problem was Jack's indiscretions. He was so blatant about it, and it was humiliating for her. And I think that was what the problem was there. It wasn't a question of other women. It was the humiliation.
Well, the Marilyn Monroe thing really must have driven her nuts.
Yeah, can you imagine that? Yeah, that was kind of something that went on in front of the whole country on everyone's television set.
Wasn't Aristotle married at the time?
No.
No, he was not, huh?
No. He was divorced. However, he had had a long relationship with Maria Callas, and everyone just assumed that Maria was the person, if he did marry, he would marry her. And she was devastated when he married Jacqueline. It did destroy Maria.
So he dumped Maria.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. That was not a problem.
Next up, East of the Rockies. It's your turn. Hi there.
Hi.
Yeah, go ahead, sir.
Yeah, I'm calling you from Sioux City, Iowa, George, and it's been a coon's age trying to get a hold of you.
Well, I'm glad you're in now.
My question is to January and you, George. Where and how did Oswald get the money to travel to and from Russia?
Oswald. His name always comes up whenever we do interviews on this. As far as Oswald is concerned, I believe that he is exactly what he said he was. He was a patsy. He was set up to take the fall, which he did. as far as where he got the money. I don't have a trail because whoever paid him would never have left a trail. However, I suspect that he was swept into this network and web.
Did anyone who played a part in the assassination back in 1963, are they alive today, do you know?
Wow, I don't know that. The man that I name as the actual assassin and shooter, I know that he is not alive. I really don't know. It would be hard to track all these particular people. You have to look at this assassination, and it was one of the most well-financed. It was the perfect crime. Interestingly enough, just this month in Vanity Fair, Dominic Dunn comments about another book about this assassination called Nemesis. And in that book, Peter Evans connects definitively Onassis to the Robert Kennedy assassination. So you have to look at Onassis as a man with wealth and power, and I believe he could have ordered the assassination of anyone, anytime, anywhere, and gotten away with it.
And it would never be linked to him, would it?
No, absolutely not.
First time caller line, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hello, my name's Chris. I'm calling from Paris, Kentucky.
Hi, Chris.
My flaw with your theory is I'm an avid hunter, avid shooter, and if I was going to assassinate somebody, I would really want to make sure my loved one was not sitting within feet of them.
Good point.
Once the bullet leaves the gun, there is no you know, assurance as to where it's going to go.
That was
How many people were hit besides, you know, JFK at the time?
Right, Chris. That was a problem for me, too, when I first started going into my research. And I think that when we talk about this assassination, Onassis hired the best in the world. He would not have been privy to the actual mechanics and how this assassination was going to be carried out. He would not want to have any connection to these assassins. They were the best in the world. They did a triangular shooting. I think that no one anticipated how close to the assassination Jackie would be and how devastating an experience it would be for her.
Oh, no question about
Consequently, I think that is the reason Onassis, on the day of the assassination, flew to Washington. I feel that's why his presence was there in the White House. I think that's why he spoke to the First Lady alone. I'm sure he was there to reassure her, to comfort her. And, I mean, I think he probably would have told her that JFK was a marked man and it was just a matter of time till someone killed him. Certainly wouldn't have been Onassis.
Well, I'm sure he didn't admit that.
Yeah, right.
Well, he must have been really upset, though, when he saw pictures of Jackie scrambling around trying to put the president's brains back in on his head.
Exactly. I think it probably would have been something he would have visualized as maybe Mrs. Lincoln going to the Ford Theater and sitting next to someone who was shot with one bullet in the back of his head like Abraham Lincoln. Here we have a man who was just, you know, slaughtered in front of the whole country.
Did Onassis hate Kennedy?
I think there was hatred. Definitely we have documented hatred between Onassis and Bobby. And I'm sure there was a carryover to JFK. I think Onassis, he did business with Joe, and I think he considered Joe's sons as just basically that, Joe's sons, and not really the powers to be reckoned with.
What was the age difference between the two, do you know, between Jackie and Aristotle?
Oh, there was 28 years difference.
28 years.
Yeah, he was quite a bit older than her. But that wasn't a problem, you know, for her at all. She preferred older men. Jack was 13 years older
13,
than her.
Yeah. Wild card line, your turn. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, good morning, Jackie January.
January.
Good morning.
Yes, I
bet people do call you Jackie, too, don't they, January?
Yes, they do sometimes.
Right.
I'm sorry, it's kind of close there.
Yeah.
I wanted to tell you a story that was told by a radio host here in San Francisco on the morning program.
Mm-hmm.
Years ago, he was a travel agent, and he was telling the story that he had heard rumors that before Jackie married Jack,
mm-hmm.
she had been down in the Bahamas, at a hotel registered under the name Jackie Bouvier.
Uh-huh.
And Aristotle was there at the same time, and it's there in the old handwritten hotel register.
Wow, I'd love to see that. I'd love to see that. That would even take their relation back further than I've been able to document.
Well, he's on KSFO in San Francisco and the morning host, and I'm sure he can be found. And
yeah, absolutely.
He personally looked at the old records.
And he saw that. Wow.
Yes.
That's quite amazing.
All right, thanks.
Thank you.
By the way, I got this message in from Stephanie out of Anchorage, Alaska. Listen to this one, Jane.
Okay.
It says, my grandpa was Jack Ruby's lawyer at the time he shot Oswald. After a number of death threats against my family, he gave the case to his partner, who mysteriously died a short time later. My grandpa was Bill McMahon, and he died the oldest lawyer in Dallas at the time, with all his secrets. Well, how about that?
You know, going back to that question about Jack and Onassis, aside from Jack Kennedy banning Onassis from entering the country, he would call him a pirate. He did not care for Onassis at all.
Let's go to our West of the Rockies line. Welcome to Coast to Coast. You're on the air. Hi.
Hi there, and good morning to you folks.
Me too, sir.
I think she was a spiteful woman just like Princess Diana, so she would have messed around or played with fire in a sense. But on the other hand, I think Onassis is small potatoes compared to the elite like the Rockefellers, Rothschilds, Bilderbergers. And given that he was going to terminate the Federal Reserve and that the military industrial complex wanted to get into Vietnam and deal with the Russians on making expensive bombs and stuff, the whole machinery, I think, offered a lot of advantages for a lot of people. And I think if Onassis was involved at all, it was just because he had connections in Italy.
Yeah, maybe he was the financier. Who knows?
You know? Well, he would be a front man, a good front man. And, you know, his reward in the mafia, it's often a reward to take the spouse of your enemy.
Yes, that's true.
And I don't think he was the main cog in the wheel. Also, you might be familiar with the Northwoods Project there, George.
Yeah.
And which is a blueprint for 9/11. And I think that because Kennedy vetoed that and the fact that he was going to take down the Federal Reserve, which would have broken the back of the Illuminati's control over the United States, that this was the main recourse. And there's a fellow by the name of Robert Groden, who was an advisor for Oliver Stone, and he's got a video out called The Assassination Files that shows multiple silhouettes on the sixth floor, shows two rifles being brought out of the building, one a sniper rifle and one the Garcano, or whatever you call it. And I just think Onassis wouldn't be able to gamble with that many, without a complicated event. I don't think he would have gambled.
Well,
that's
why I'm saying in my theory that he was definitely not involved in the actual assassination planning. He was behind the scenes. He would have hired these people through intermediaries. The people who were hired, they most likely did not even know who they were working for. And as far as the Rockefellers and the Rothschilds, Onassis, prior to the assassination, was just considered another Greek. Once he married Jacqueline, he was now socially dining with the Rockefellers and the Rothschilds. She was a business acquisition.
He needed that.
She opened doors to him that previously had been closed tight.
He knew that.
Yes.
He knew that. Let's go to our first-time caller line. You're up. Hi there.
Hello, is this George Nuri?
It is.
Oh, I love your show. January Jones, this is something your theory is what I've been telling people for 20 years, and if somebody drove to my attention then that how much Onassis looks like John Kennedy, the spitting image, he's a Greek-looking boy, he does not look Irish, and in 63 when he was born, that's when he was engaged to Lee Radziwill, her sister, and then Jackie took over in his favor, and I think that son was conceived at that time, and 3 years, almost to the day, John Kennedy was killed. 3 years when John would have been 3 years old, John Kennedy was killed. And it's just, and I also think that probably Onassis killed Marilyn Monroe and for Jackie because she hated her so much and tried to get them involved. And what do you think?
What do you think, January?
The public and throw down, and why did they cremate John Kennedy's body the minute he died so there'd be no DNA trail? And who took him down from the air just like Onassis' son?
Wow.
Hold on. Take a breath and let's take a breath.
Great God.
Take a breath and let's let January respond to that.
Wow. George, I think we're talking to someone who may be more obsessed with this topic than me.
Can we find one?
I think we have. Many of the things you're saying are things that I totally agree with. And it's nice to know that you have thought about this theory and agree with me.
Well, if there was indeed a conspiracy, and I, January, do believe there was one.
Yes, I do.
Who
too.
Was involved, who are the players, I do not know. But mm-hmm. I do believe that there was more than just one person.
Absolutely.
It's very possible to assume that Aristotle, in what he was looking for, the mob, what they were looking for, the CIA, some of these bankers, and, you know, all kinds of people. It's almost as if everybody knew what was happening except poor John Kennedy.
Yeah, you know, he was kind of removed from all of this. He was the center of the attention. In my movie script, I portray him absolutely as the victim, and there were forces swirling around that were beyond his control.
What was the name of the psychic, Ruth, that she said several days before that Kennedy was going to be killed?
I can't remember
her name. Yeah. Ruth. I think it was Ruth something. It'll come to me.
At one point, George, I spoke to a psychic about this, my theory, and she confirmed for me that this blood feud between the Kennedys and the Onassis family is something that went back generations.
I'll tell you what, though. I think the Federal Reserve and the plan to abolish it had a lot to do with this.
I'm sure that...
Gene Dixon. That's who it was. A psychic Gene Dixon.
Gene Dixon. A very, very reputable psychic. I'm sure that there was just so much involved. But when I get down to 40 years later, still looking at this crime, I think it gets back to the simple basics: passion, power, money.
That's the name of the game, isn't it, January?
And when you look at any assassination throughout history, those will probably be factors that you have to look at.
Where do people get your book, Jackie?
Amazon.com, and my website is January Jones, which has more information.
And now this is going to be a movie, too?
Well, I have a movie script, 2044, and we're out there trying to get it made.
Negotiating.
Yes, we are.
Good
and
luck.
It's, I think it would be a fascinating topic to tackle. I think everyone has looked at the assassination through Oliver Stone's eyes, and he did a brilliant movie. However, I think we need to look at the assassination through a woman's eyes. And I've tried to approach a very, very complicated crime with a woman's common sense.
Very good, January. Thanks so much. You take care of yourself.
You too.
That was still another theory. But when we come right back, Bruce Adamson has another one. Get ready for this. Bruce Adamson is a genealogist and historian. He's traveled throughout the country gathering photographs and materials for his books. In 1991 through 92, Adamson began researching the JFK assassination. He became certain that Oswald was indeed the lone assassin. Well, this belief was shattered, though, by the discovery of George D. Mournshield, and Adamson is now convinced that the conspiracy will soon be solved. The entire foundation of the 13 volumes, the JFK Assassination Timeline Chart, and Oswald's closest friend, the George D. Mournshield story, is a result of 10 detailed years, and a thorough research of D. Mournshield's personal address and phone book. Our guest this hour on Coast to Coast, Bruce Adamson. Hi, Bruce. How are you?
Pretty good. How you doing?
Good. Lots of work you put into this one, my friend.
Well, I won a case against the federal government, pro per, in 1993, and I was given 2 years back pay, and instead of blowing the money, actually right when Oliver Stone's movie came out. And at first I didn't like the movie, and then after watching it 2 or 3 times, I thought it was he did a really good job. But then I came across the Mournshield, who dated Jackie Kennedy's mother in 1938. And then I started making all these other connections, and I read that he committed suicide in Palm Beach, and for 6 months before that, he said that Oswald was set up for the assassination. Well, I contacted the West Palm Beach Sheriff's Office, and they gave me a photocopy of De Mournshield's personal phone book.
Uh-huh.
And they didn't have the time to go through and research as a genealogist. I've been a genealogist since 1982.
So you've got the training behind
the training,
you.
Yeah. They're used to looking at people that have criminal records. I'm good at digging up dirt on people that are rich and famous that donate their papers to libraries. And I've been doing my own family, and this is much more controversial. So, but the federal government, I won a case as a whistleblower, so I've been getting a steady income, which has allowed me.
Well, can you, not to digress for a bit here, Bruce, but can you tell us what you jumped all over here with the government?
It was with the Postal Service, but yet I did write a book on my fourth great grandfather, Rufus Easton, who they just honored very nicely in St. Louis as first postmaster of St. Louis.
Sure, that's my hometown, by the way.
And, well, Rufus, I wrote a whole book on him. That's my favorite book, 300 pages. And Rufus had his first, built the first post office right down by the arch where that church is in the parking lot.
Oh, yeah.
I know, Third and Elm.
Know that well. So, but you blew the whistle on something.
Yeah, it was in a harassment. I kept getting retaliated against.
You were?
Yeah, and so what I did is I became the supervisor of supervisors. I didn't know. I had somebody helping me who was a lawyer off the record, who had worked with the state government.
Well, don't say off the record when you're on this show, because you're being broadcast to millions of people right now.
Well, I went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. I didn't win that case, but I won my workers' comp.
Okay, but so you at least had experience in investigating through your genealogy background and your background as a historian.
Right.
What was it, though, that kind of perked you up when you started investigating De Mornshield? I mean, because most people, it would have just gone right over their head.
Well, I went through the 26 volumes of the Warren Commission report, and I came across George and John Ligon De Mornshield.
Did his name keep coming up?
Well, no, there was 240 pages of testimony.
All right.
And then one thing led to one discovery left, came over another and another. It was like discovering gold. And I said, geez, this is a good nugget. And then I contacted Leon Panetta in 1992, and he supported my research up until he became chief of staff of Bill Clinton.
All right. Well, tell us then, who is this person? Who was this person? Because, as you said, he committed suicide.
Well, George De Mornshield was Lee Harvey Oswald. He's actually a CIA agent, an oil geologist, and he became Lee Harvey Oswald's best friend prior to the assassination. And Oswald looked up to him.
All right.
And
well, now, wait a minute. You had said earlier that he dated Jacqueline Onassis's mother?
Right, Lee Bouvier.
Okay, and he ends up being Lee Harvey Oswald's best friend?
That's right. That's what got me going. When you said that's what, I had like a nightmare, and then I found out that Jackie purchased the pink Chanel suit from De Mornshield's aunt by marriage in New York City.
The suit she wore on the day of the assassination?
Yeah, at the clothing store Che Neon, which was owned by Nona McAdoo. Nona McAdoo was the aunt by marriage to George De Mornshield. And Jackie purchased this Chanel suit. And then I found out that De Mornshield was friends with Jackie's dress designer, Oleg, and his brother, Igor Cassini.
So this guy was everywhere.
He is. He knows all the top oilmen, Texas oilmen, H.L. Hunt, Clint Murchison, Herman and George Brown, Lyndon Johnson's best friends. He's writing, it just goes on and on.
And this guy was in the CIA at the time?
Yeah, I found out, I won a case when Bill Clinton was in there. They gave me a Freedom of Information Act that I served in 1994 on De Mornshield's father-in-law, who was in charge of 250 CIA agents from 1950 to 53.
All right, now, what makes you believe that De Mornshield was somehow tied into the assassination in some form or fashion?
Well, he said that Oswald was not guilty of the assassination, and before he put a shotgun in his mouth and pulled the trigger in West Palm Beach, Florida.
Did he ever have a suicide note or anything like that?
No, he was giving interviews to authors or newspaper writers, and like a guy named William Altman's, who just passed away.
Now, how do we know De Mornshield committed suicide and he wasn't killed?
Well, I have the actual audio tape in on my video, which I produced, which was shown today in Manhattan.
Audio tape of what?
Of De Mornshield's suicide.
You mean he put a tape recorder?
No, his first wife's sister, who he was staying in their home, set the tape recorder to record the soap operas. Yet they leave a shotgun and bullets out for him, and he made his.
So you could hear in the background the shotgun?
Gunshot, and I have it on the actual video. And then you hear his daughter discovering it 20 minutes later.
Oh, my God.
And you hear her screaming. That was the chilling thing. Alexandria de Mornschild had an affair in 64.
Is there any way, Bruce, that when we go to the break in about 10 minutes, that you can get a portion of that ready and maybe hold the phone by your by the tape so we can
I've played it on Dr. Stan. Sometime in the future, I could have it all queued up.
You can't get it ready in about 10 minutes.
No, I'm here with candlelight, and I'm just kind of focused in on what we're doing.
Candlelight.
Yeah. But well, shoot, pun intended.
Well, now let's go back a little bit, I want to piece this together because you put together a timeline here on this assassination. So de Mornschild is in the CIA. He gets to know Oswald. He's dating Jackie Kennedy's mother.
That's in 1938.
Prior to.
Yeah.
But he's got this relationship with all these people.
Right.
What do you think his role was in the assassination?
Well, I think he set Oswald up to take the blame. And whatever he told Oswald to do,
Oswald would do,
yeah. And I believe that Oswald was CIA. I believe that Dr. Philip Mullinson, his book, Spy Saga, is definitive on that. And it's a short book, and I believe that Oswald, what helps clear Oswald, in my opinion, and this gentleman was calling earlier, with Mr. Fetzer,
yes,
and is that Oswald doesn't have any gunpowder nitrates on his face. He does have gunpowder on his hands. So if he was really trying to kill Kennedy, he would have been looking down the scope of the rifle, and Mr. Fetzer would have been the one to answer it, and he would have been able to answer this. How could somebody shoot a rifle and have gunpowder on their hands and not on their face?
On their face. You'd have it all over your chin and everything
right,
else.
Right, right. And he didn't have time to wash his hands and so forth, and that I think is important. And Oswald saying that he was set up for a patsy.
Now, you also in your timeline, you also mentioned though in your research that de Mornschild also knew or somehow was tied into Abraham Zapruder, the
right
person who took the film. What was that relationship?
Well, de Mornschild's wife, his fourth wife, Jeanne Lagan, worked with Abe Zapruder at a clothing store in Dallas.
Now, what are the odds of all this happening, Bruce?
Well, and what are the odds of you taking a picture of somebody being assassinated and not reacting for your own safety?
That's a good point.
And they both belong.
It's not like he was a professional photographer and that was his job. You know?
And that was a good point that Mr. Fetzer made, that that he had vertigo.
Yeah.
When you're hearing, he says he hears the bullets whistling by his head. But what, you're not going to drop the camera and react like everybody else is in the line of your camera?
Yeah.
Well, both de Mornschild and Jean Lagan de Mornschild worked at this clothing company. They're both white Russians. And they worked with the mother of Lyndon Johnson's personal secretary, Olga Femer. And Marie Femer, still alive today in Washington, became one of the first woman senior officers at the CIA.
This thing's like a soap opera.
Oh, it's great once you get it down.
I mean, let me tell you something. The fact that you are such an expert in facts, in genealogy, tells me a lot because you're a facts and numbers guy. I mean,
yeah, I'm not theory. I'm just go with the facts, and I don't. I have cousins that are friends of George and Barbara Bush that sponsored one of my books, The Life and Times of George W. Ely.
Mm-hmm.
But yet I found the most incriminating evidence against George Bush Sr.
Oh, really?
And I don't discriminate. I didn't go after Lyndon Johnson because he's a Democrat. I didn't go after George Bush Sr. because he's a Republican. I just go where the evidence leads me to.
Well, wasn't Sr. in the CIA at the time?
Well, I can prove he's in the CIA in 1953, and his Zapata oil platforms were parked right above Castro's Cuba when he took over January 1st, 1959?
Mm-hmm.
And so the Zapata Oil Company was a front, and that was the code name for the Bay of Pigs invasion. Well, I was able to circumstantially prove that George Bush Sr., he wrote me a letter, which I believe you have, admitting that he knew George DeMarchal since 1942. That's George Herbert Walker Bush.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then I was able to circumstantially prove that Bush was in charge of the Bay of Pigs invasion, which was codenamed Operation Zapata, and that was George Bush's oil company, Zapata Oil. And two of the boats were called the Barbara J. and the Houston.
That's true. You are right about that.
And then I was able. Then you have J. Edgar Hoover briefing George Bush of the CIA the day after the assassination. And then you have this mysterious call by George Bush to the Houston FBI office where he says that he knows this guy, James Parrott, who was talking about somebody killing the president.
So you tell me, Bruce, then, with all these facts that you've uncovered and kind of weaved through pretty eloquently, by the way.
Thank you.
What do you think the motive was to kill?
Well, I think there are a number of motives, and that's why it's kind of confusing for the average person.
Sure, absolutely.
I believe the firing of Alan Dulles, a CIA director. I have Alan Dulles going to Houston, meeting the head CIA agent in Houston.
Which you think Dulles gets upset because he gets fired?
And his friends.
And his friends. They're all out now. Boom. And I guess they got fired not because they were doing a poor job leading the CIA. I have a feeling Kennedy...
The Bay of Pigs invasion,
right.
which was Bush's operation with Edwin Pauley. And Edwin Pauley, keep in mind, is listed four times in DeMarchal's phone book and is the chairman of the Democratic Party of California.
Okay. So they get fired. They get upset. You think that's what gets the ball rolling here?
I do, and I believe Texas oilmen were upset because the Kennedys wanted to remove or reduce the oil depletion allowance, which allowed the wealthy Texas oilmen to take 27.5% of their income taxes and reinvest it into other companies.
Uh-huh.
And then there's a couple other motives that anybody having prior knowledge could have made a fortune off the New York Stock Exchange. Well, the Bush family has their other side that nobody ever looks at are the Walkers. The Walkers are one of the biggest security firms and oldest security firms on Wall Street.
Mm-hmm.
And anybody having prior knowledge could sell their companies, you know, a week, a month, 6 months before, and then buy it back for like one-tenth the cost. Because the day Kennedy was shot, there was $21 billion lost in the New York Stock Exchange.
Oh, it just plummeted, didn't it?
Yes. And so that would be a motive. And then
How about wanting to come back and retake Cuba, Vietnam? Was it all part of it?
Well, no, there is a Vietnam connection, and that is through Ruth Forbes Payne, who is the mother of Michael and Ruth Hyde Payne of Irving, Texas.
My gosh, do you know these names?
Yeah, Ruth Forbes Payne is the first cousin to John Forbes Carey. And this is interesting. I just found this out 3 days before the election.
The whole thing's a conspiracy.
It is. And
how many people do you think were involved in this thing?
Well, Ruth Forbes Payne's best friend was a CIA agent, Mary Bancroft. She wrote a book called Autobiography of a Spy, and she worked with Alan Dulles on the assassination attempt on Adolf Hitler.
And okay, but you know, with all these names, though, that you've given us.
Yeah, it's hard to keep them.
And all these theories. You can't say for sure that every one of them was involved in the assassination, can you?
I have a letter from Marina Oswald to Ruth Hyde Payne saying, is your mother-in-law, who is Ruth Forbes Payne, and her friends going to help us? This is in June of 63. At the same time, DeMarchal is tied to the Paynes, and so is his brother, Dimitri.
William, what do you think she meant by help us? Financially? Because of what?
Right. But, well, Ruth Forbes Payne's friends, Mary Bancroft, is Henry Luce, who purchased the Zapruder film. Alan Dulles, who was CIA director, is the lover. Her best friend, Mary Bancroft, is the lover of Alan Dulles, who is the first Warren commissioner and CIA director that Kennedy fired. and also the lover of Henry Luce, who owns Time Life, Fortune Magazine.
My, oh, my, oh, my.
And then her husband is Arthur Young, the inventor of the Bell helicopter, and they made millions off the war of Arthur Young and Ruth Lord's Payne made millions off the war in Vietnam and the Korean Wars. And yet they founded this Institute of Consciousness at Berkeley, like they're real peaceful people, yet they're making millions, you know, like Colonel Fletcher Prouty pointed out, that that there were like 5,000 helicopters lost, and they're just they're getting royalties up the yin yang.
How many people do you think were involved in this conspiracy, numbers wise?
Well, there are a lot of associations, and a lot of people just do what they're told.
Do you think some people didn't even know what was going to happen?
A lot of people are shocked and emotionally tied to it, and they can't really sit back and make a rational judgment.
But you know, if you have to look at a puzzle as it's complete from the top, or you're not going to have any idea what it is. And I wonder how many people were little pieces of a puzzle, and they just didn't know what the whole picture was.
Yeah, there are some of those.
Stay with us. Bruce Adamson, our guest. He's a genealogist. My gosh, he put some stuff into this. And we'll take your phone calls when we come right back. Bruce, I have to ask you this before we go to phone calls. You won a case in 2003 against the CIA in which it was stated that Mohammed al-Fayed, who was the father of Dodi Fayed, who died in the car crash with Princess Diana, was in business with De Mornshield
in 1964.
And they were representing at the time a fellow by the name of El Amir Atta?
Atta, which happens to be the same name as the father of the lead hijacker of September 11th.
Could it have been one and the same?
I've been on Dr. Stan's show asking this question. You know, I've approached people at the Pentagon, give it to law enforcement agencies. The FIA had lost the lawsuit against the Pentagon and the CIA 2 months before the crash. And then his brother-in-law is Anand Khashoggi, who is the personal advisor to the Saudi royal family.
Sure, and he was a gun runner, too, wasn't he?
He was in charge of Iran-Contra.
Yeah.
The missile deal, and he worked very closely with Bush and at the time of the crash in 2001, Bush Sr.
His ship at the time, the Nabiya.
He had the largest ship in the
world. Was used in a James Bond movie, by the way.
I know he had one of the largest one. Yep. And
named after his daughter, I think, something like that.
But Khashoggi lost a nephew. Dodi al-Fayed was his nephew. That's blood.
I didn't know that.
And he was in business at Barrick Gold with George Bush Sr., with people, a lot of other important directors in 2001. And he sold his condominium that he paid $36 million for in the 70s for half the price.
Where was it?
At the Olympia Towers. It's either Olympic or the Olympia Towers in downtown New York for half price, $17 million.
He bought it for $36 million and sold it for $7 million. Who bought it?
I don't know that, but it's in the New York Times and it's on the internet that
strange weaving.
You know, like they knew something, get out of town, you know.
Strange weaves. Okay, let's go to the phones. You ready?
Yeah.
And we'll continue chatting about your theories, too. East of the Rockies, you're on Coast to Coast with our guest, Bruce Adamson. Hi there.
Hey, is this John in New Orleans?
Hi, John.
Thank you. Just an introductory thing. The two presidents that I've sung for it bothers me that they were both LBJ and Gerald Ford. I think that's a thread that runs through what I'm about to tell you. The other thing about your little blurb there about the military-industrial complex, that was just a picture on my mantelpiece about Uncle Bob and Eisenhower on the golf course playing golf.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And did you say you sang for these two presidents?
Well, through circumstances.
So,
yes.
So you're a singer by trade, I guess, huh?
Thank you, sir.
Okay, go ahead.
But the truth is that I was in the Civil Air Patrol Squadron at the Lakefront Airport out in New Orleans in the late 50s, early 60s. And that, of course, as you already have flashed to in your brains, involved, David Ferry.
David Ferry, Barry Seal.
So who's the other name?
Barry Seal. He threatened Bush Sr. and he was assassinated 10 days later.
Yeah, you know that stuff. I do not. I was in the eye of the hurricane. I was an innocent, like, high school age person. But, okay, so I was hypnotized by David Ferry at one of the mixed parties. Usually the guys just got together, sat on the floor, and shined their shoes to look like patent leather. This was a mixed party with the girls. David Ferry hypnotized me. By the way, if you don't know, you already do know that, you know, Oswald came out of that same squadron about a year, year and a half out of me and my guys.
Did you know him?
I did not know, but I could have met Oswald inadvertently without knowing. Because, you know, back in those days, you don't know what you know.
Did David Ferry ever tell you anything?
No.
Okay.
Except get that, you know, SOB maybe. The same way that the person at the top of the LBJ...
But he hated Kennedy.
Yeah, the JFK movie, you know, Perry Russo standing up in the Napoleon House.
Sure.
And tried to got that SOB.
I
knew Perry Russo and, you know, Leighton Martins, the composite character from, you know, Kevin Bacon played them in the movie.
Was Ferry's portrayal pretty accurate in the movie?
No, sir. He was not that little, scatterbrained, flighty.
Right.
He was a, you know, I can't put the terms in here. They have to be filled with blanks.
But he was disciplined and knew what he was doing.
Oh, God. Yeah, he was like a triple, I could say triple threat and be, polite, but I'm not going to be dramatic because I don't know, but I would, you know, in my own conjuring up a triple agent.
Well, and it is interesting, Bruce, how, again, so many people, Oswald, De Mornshield, David Ferry, I mean, they just all knew each other. It was almost like a club, a sick club, huh, Bruce?
Well, I know that De Mornshield was taking Oswald to parties in February of 63, and yet he was writing President Kennedy to write the foreword of his 3,000-mile donkey trip through Central America.
Now, the Oswald that he knew was the Oswald that we saw get arrested and subsequently shot by Jack Ruby, right?
Right.
Okay, so because I've always heard that there might be several Oswalds out there.
Yeah, there's a new book that's come out that draws that theory. I haven't, you know, dove into that. I just stick with De Mornshield.
Now, with De Mornshield, did he ever admit to anything?
Yeah, he told William Oltmans that Oswald...
And who's William? William who?
Oltmans, a Dutch journalist.
All right.
That Oswald was set up for the assassination. And then he was corresponding with his friend, CIA Director George Herbert Walker Bush, and I sued the CIA on the actual letters. Where are they? And they were purged. They were destroyed. But in this CIA document, De Mornshield is being harassed and threatened, saying that if he doesn't kill himself, that they're going to get him.
Well, why would De Mornshield, after all these years, talk to a Dutch reporter and tell him that Oswald basically was the patsy?
Well, I believe his conscience was catching up to him. I really think that he felt bad about it.
How old was he when he apparently did himself
in? He was approved for a $300,000 line of credit when he had very poor credit. By Brown Brothers and Harriman.
For what? What was he going to do with the money?
Well, this is when before the assassination. They gave him a $300,000 line of credit, and it was he went right across the street from where Prescott Bush was at Brown Brothers and Harriman. He retired as senator on the day De Mornshield's April 11th. Prescott Bush retires from Brown Brothers and Harriman.
And they're the ones who gave
De Mornshield a $300,000 line of credit and De Mornshield had an office in the CIA Trust Republic National Bank Building in Dallas.
What do you think he did with the money?
I think he ran out by 1977, you know, but $300,000 was a lot of money back in 1963.
Oh, absolutely. You think he used the money for the assassination?
No, I think he lived well with it.
Okay, so he just pocketed
and then
the money.
Then he sees that he doesn't have anything, but he knows that he's got something worth money. He's trying to sell his new book.
Was it hush money?
I believe so. He had a book called I'm a Patsy, I'm a Patsy, and he was pushing this book, thinking he could make lots of money. He was meeting with Henry Luce's top people at Time Life, Will Rapoli.
What character, if any, was De Mornshield in the JFK Oliver Stone movie?
He was played by William Oltmans. Oliver Stone and William Oltmans died a couple months ago, were friends. and they both went to Yale University.
I'm trying to remember the character, though.
He's a white-haired guy.
The Mournshield was?
Yeah, they gave him. He wasn't in the big screen version. He was in the one you take.
Oh, he was. Okay, all right. That's probably why I didn't see it. Okay, first time caller line. Welcome to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, Bruce, and hi, George. How you guys doing?
Welcome, sir. Good.
He was referring to the director's cut. I know it well. I've seen it many times. I have two questions and a factoid. The one question is that was the Bush family, in particular George Herbert Walker Bush, involved with the assassination? Did they benefit? And second of all, the factoid is that one of the Oswald doubles, as it were part of George Bush's daddy's staff. Third question is there, you mentioned something about a video. Do you have a phone number or something like a little flyer or catalog that you mail out? Or?
Well, I've got a website, and I have it, all 13 books, which is 1,800 pages on a CD that I will offer for half price to George's listeners, pun intended.
Okay, but is there a phone number? I don't have access to the website at the moment.
Okay, I can give you a phone number, but don't call tonight.
Okay.
And any other listener, maybe call tomorrow or something. It's
831
465-9272.
9272.
And I'll give you the P.O. box of my address, which is P.O. Box 1003, Aptos, that's APTOS, California, 95001. And the website is really easy to remember, and that's CIAJFK.com.
Okay. Do you offer, let's say, videos and books as far as DVDs?
Well, what I've been doing is anybody who will sponsor my video, there goes the phone, anybody who will sponsor the video.
Why don't you throw that phone about a mile away there?
I've just dropped it in the toilet.
Did you really?
No.
No. All right. I never know with you statisticians.
What I'll do, if for any listener, I'll mention the cities that I've already got the video on. It's in Manhattan, Brooklyn, Tucson, Phoenix, Sacramento, Santa Cruz.
We're in every market.
Los Angeles. And I'm looking like St. Louis. I want to get a sponsor for Public Access TV. I also produced a video on my uncle's songwriting career. He wrote over 300 songs for the movie.
Okay, I can get your name in St. Louis later. But okay. Let's get back to your question. Do I want to give us your question again?
I won't answer the one about the second Oswald because I'm not an authority on that.
Okay. Now, what's your other question?
The other question was the Bush family and or George Herbert Walker Bush involved with the assassination, and did they benefit?
Well, I have a letter from Prescott Bush to Mrs. Allen Dulles right after Allen Dulles died in 69.
Okay, what does that say?
And it says, and it's only a few months after Robert Kennedy was assassinated, and he said to Mrs. Allen Dulles, Prescott Bush, that I never forgave the Kennedys for what they did to Allen over the Bay of Pigs fiasco. They made him seem the goat. Well, that was his son's operation for the CIA.
Yeah, but that doesn't mean he was part of the assassination. He may have been ticked off.
Well, his banking firm gave de Mournshield a $300,000 line of credit when his credit, he didn't have credit.
That doesn't mean they were part of the assassination.
Well, then George Bush is friends with Lee Harvey Oswald's best friend since 1942.
That doesn't mean that they pulled the trigger.
Well, it's circumstantial.
Circumstantial. That's what I wanted you to say. Next up, let's go to our East of the Rockies line. You're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Hello. How are you?
I'm doing fine. Thanks.
Thank you very much for taking my call. I was just going to ask Bruce if he had looked into Major General Edwin Walker being tied into the Walker Bush.
That's a good question. I tried to do the genealogy, but Walker is a pretty common name. I'm still looking at Chuck Norris to see if Texas Walker Ranger is related. But I'm not just kidding there.
Don't, because people will believe you.
No. No, that was a very good question, and I could not. The Walker, Edwin Walker, you see, it's so important. The point that he's bringing up, because on April the 5th, Oswald allegedly shoots at right-wing General Edwin Walker. and the Kennedys had belittled Edwin Walker by putting him in an institution because he was handing out flyers calling Eleanor Roosevelt a communist. He was a John Bircher, and
which was way right at the time. I don't know where they are now, but
yeah,
they were way right.
But they're, you know, not that all John Birchers are bad. But what I did find is I found that Lyndon Johnson and de Mornschild are writing to one another a week after the Walker shooting. And de Mornschild meets with Lyndon Johnson 2 weeks after the Walker shooting, which is 7 months before the assassination. I was the first to publish these letters that I found in LBJ's library in Austin, Texas.
Who do you think put this all together? Do you think de Mornschild was the mastermind of this assassination?
I do, and I don't think it was for... I think he was approached by the Texas oilmen, but I don't think he his heart was there. He was friends with Igor Cassini, and on April 7th, 2 days or 3 days before the Walker shooting, when de Mornschild was hanging out with Oswald, Mrs. Igor Cassini committed suicide. And because of Bobby Kennedy.
Are you concerned about your own safety with all these facts, figures, names?
No, I've had colonels. Colonel Bo Greitz has supported me, Colonel Fletcher Prouty, Colonel of the Army, who is a California Deputy Attorney General, Leon Panetta. And I've been doing national radio shows since 96. And I've been publishing my books since 96. And if anything happens to me, my books, the hard copy, goes into public domain. So would you rather have 300 to 500 people selling my books or just one person?
Yeah, really. I can see where it is. International Line, you're up. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hey, George. How's it going?
Going fine, sir.
Hey, I listen all the time, and I'm in awe at how professional you are.
Well, I better be or they'll fire me.
Okay, well, let me continue then.
Okay.
I have a theory. Now, the more you think about it, in fact, when you go to bed tonight, you may sit back and think, gee, you know, that guy's theory was kind of interesting. I don't think it so much pertains to your guest, although he can do some research if he's in the Dallas area. Okay, here's my little theory.
All right.
I'll just drop it on you, and then you can either talk about it or just think about it later. Okay? Hello?
Go.
Okay. Okay, let's assume that, yes, Oswald was there with a gun and shot a few shots, right? Okay, now let's assume that there were other shots that hit the president, okay? Now, the question is, how do you get rid of those other bullets and lead it back to Oswald? Now, the research your guest could do is to look into companies in the Dallas area that sold dry ice.
Dry ice?
Refrigeration. Get this.
All
okay.
Right.
Now, let's say the guy in the grassy knoll and the other point of the triangle, okay? Now, this is far off, but I've seen it done. Bullets made of ice.
Good point.
Right.
Good
so,
point. And they hit, they melt, and they're gone.
Well, they hit the president in the front as a bullet,
right,
but exited like a shotgun shell.
Good point. Now, they wouldn't have that shattering effect, but you're absolutely right.
It's like the stray bullet that hit the sidewalk?
Yep. And matter of fact, I've even seen that in movies where they have used dry ice bullets, and they do the dastardly job. Maybe you want to check into that too, Bruce.
Well... I don't know. But it sounds interesting.
All right, so where does your research take you next? What's next?
Well, right now I'm working on a video on Rufus Eason. I started 20 years ago on a book on my fourth great-grandfather, Rufus. And then I designed the Barrymore family website, which focuses on the Drew family and the Costello family. And John Barrymore was able to he's a computer whiz, put all my books on CD.
So you love this genealogy stuff.
Right? Oh, yeah. I'm a storyteller.
Computer made your life easier?
Well, I used to be a postal employee, and I helped the postal inspectors on 5 occasions, and one time they came in and gave me a $1,000 reward,
right,
and I bought my first computer with it.
All right, Bruce. Thanks for your theory. You've looked at a lot of stats, I'll tell you. You probably looked at more than the Warren Commission, to tell you the truth. For Steve Carr, Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesur, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie. Somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM, I'll see you on our next edition. Thanks for participating in the program tonight. Be safe, everyone.